So in the midst of the financial crisis, the worst moments came when, and you'll remember this, when the credit markets began to freeze up. And it wasn't because of ice and snow. It had nothing to do with something clogging up the system. It wasn't money evaporated or anything. It was the simple, or it turns out not so simple, matter of being unable to set a price. In this case, the price of a loan or a security. The whole loose, fragile agreement about how to price everything, from a mortgage to a corporate bond to a stock to an interbank loan, had come undone. And if there can be no agreed-upon price, there can be no economy, folks. The same fragile, sometimes crazy-seeming arrangements govern the price of everyday things we buy. From the price of fuel, $3.25 a gallon, you've seen the prices, they're going up. That's a gallon of gas, to the price of rice, $500 a ton on the open market. Did you know that?
I don't need a ton of rice, though.
Right, but you only need, like, say, a bag of Uncle
cups.
Ben's.
Yeah, yeah.
If you buy Uncle Ben's rice at $12 a pound, that's something like $24,000 a ton. Should buy it by the ton.
That's expensive rice.
Yeah. Coffee is the best, though. $260 a ton on the open market for Arabica coffee.
$260 a ton.
$260 a ton. 75 cents for a few grams at the deli. $2.40 for the same few grams in your Starbucks latte with
a
nice cup
size?
Like this. So, I think this is a tall, maybe. That's something like $40,000 a ton for coffee. At Starbucks. You get what you pay for, baby.
I try not to do the math because it just depresses me.
Well, there's a great new book, The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. And Eduardo Porter has been researching these questions and sort of looking at the mystery of price in this book. He joins us in the studio today. Eduardo, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Now, what kind of a personality are you? Are you the kind of person who how much you pay for something is meaningful, or how little you pay for something is more meaningful?
I have become a person in the process of writing this book that is much more careful about what I pay than I used to be. I mean, before, I wouldn't even think twice about paying for some things. And now I think, what is it that I am getting when I pay, you know, $100, $250, or $1,000?
Right. You know, we've got in the studio here a bottle of rosé wine that the staff brought in. It costs $6.99.
I don't even know what that.
Yeah,
that
it's got a nice sort of La Villette, de Rosé, Châtelet, you know. So I'm told by the staff that this $6.99 bottle is rat. It's bad.
Terrible.
It's awful. Could that be because of the price?
Well, probably yes. I mean, we take prices as a cue to value. I mean, standard understanding would say, well, that, you know, you look at an item that you might want, you rationally evaluate whether that price is worth it. You know, and it also serves to compare that one item with other items and with your budget. But sometimes, you know, prices work in another way, such as with a bottle of wine. Rather than telling us, well, is this worth it or not, the higher the price goes, it tells us this is more valuable. The price itself is telling us about the value of things.
So no, at a wine store in Manhattan, I remember one time my wife used to work in a store like this. She used to say that when they really wanted to move the wine off the shelves, they'd raise the price, not lower it.
That's right. And there's this great experiment using placebo pills that shows the same sort of behavior. There was these groups of students that were given placebo pills, and they were told they were painkillers. But half the students were told these placebos cost $2.50 a pop, and half were told they cost 10 cents a pop. The people that got the $2.50 placebo reported much, much deeper pain relief than the people who got the 10-cent placebo. Hmm. And, of course, this was a sugar pill, right? This had no real therapeutic effect. But the price was acting in some, you know, real deep psychological way that these people felt cured.
When is price rational and when is it not rational? You, for instance, try to price things like atheism or the real price of parking or the price to the economy of migration and immigration.
Well, I think that rationality and irrationality both play a part in our setting of prices. So, for instance, sometimes we will pay things because we don't really understand, and that doesn't make them irrational. For instance, there was this experiment with lap dancers in which turns out that lap dancers that were at the highest peak of their fertility cycle got much bigger tips. And nobody knew that this was going on. I mean, just after
did
some...
Did you participate in these experiments?
No, I did not. I mean, they were psychologists in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And so the patrons didn't know this. The dancers hadn't realized this until somebody came and measured this. So something was going on, like, you know, under the radar. But I wouldn't say that's irrational. It's probably pretty plausible. It makes sort of sense.
It's part of the complexity.
Yeah, it's part of the complexity. But in other instances, I would say that we do have, like, irrational approaches to price. And you know, economists have looked at this and looked at our kind of biases our lack of self-control, our inability to price things far away in the future and compare them to prices in the present. And so that will lead us to kind of like decisions that are not optimal for us. And houses, as you mentioned earlier, is a very clear example of that.
All over the map, quite literally. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a Freakonomics quality to some of the discussions that we had this morning about your book. People think, for instance, that the presence of immigrants in the United States drives down the cost of labor. But when you look at the actual stats, what do you find?
Well, actually, you find that this is not necessarily the case. Because when immigrants come in, they also draw in capital into the industries in which immigrants operate. So actually, much of the most recent research has found that immigrants have no effect on the wages of the workers at the bottom end, because they're actually... There's something else going on, that they're not really competing with a lot of domestic workers. If you think of immigrants coming in from across the southern border today, they tend to be competing with other immigrants for work. And so the effect on wages in the United States is much more difficult to assess. And in fact, the effect on the average income of Americans is upwards.
But if we're going to be talking about irrational pricing and wages, I mean, this also includes the disparity between genders in terms of women doing the exact same work as a male counterpart and being paid significantly less, which still goes, people don't think it goes on today, but it still does.
It still does. If you look at government statistics, they show you that on average, women earn about 80% of what men do.
Yeah.
And if younger women the earnings of younger women are closer to those of men, about 90%. But across the whole spectrum of working age, it's about 80%. And some of this is kind of difficult to understand, difficult to explain in terms of economic processes. And some economists have suggested this might have to do with the fact that women tend to leave the labor force more than men. And this is because women have a greater responsibility for childbearing and childcare than men do still. There is no equality in this division of labor at home. And therefore, that women take themselves out of the labor force more often.
Finally, why does this $3.99, $2.98, $4.99 business work? That you do it just under $5 or just under $4, and people swallow that hook every time.
Well, yeah, it's rounding down, right? I mean, the salient number is the 4 or the 3 rather than the next number up that's not shown anywhere, right? You're not seeing a 5 when you see $4.99. You're seeing a 4. And so this will, of course, draw your attention to that, and that's where you'll focus.
But why does it work? I just don't get it.
Well, you know, we're hardwired in some way to look at what we're looking at, right? And the next step to understand that this is really closer to 5 than to 4 requires some kind of, like, mental process. Just looking at a 4 does not. You're seeing a 4, and that's what you're reacting to.
And you kind of want to be ripped off. But want to tell yourself you're getting a bargain. That's the schizophrenia in the price of everything.
Well, there's this great situation in which there was a guy in California that had a wine store, and he found one day that if he increased the prices of cheaper wines, the wines that cost like something 79 to something 99, he sold more of the wines.
Yeah, well, that's the age-old thing. Eduardo Porter, author of The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. He's on the editorial board of our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Eduardo.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow, we speak with another writer, author Amy Chua. Her essay, Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior, has caused a firestorm. It was published in the Wall Street Journal, and the forums are going crazy. Amy writes that the key to successfully raising a kid is to forbid them from a huge list of activities like sleepovers and playdates, and to settle for nothing less than A's. We're already getting reaction. Mark Hirschberger writes at our website, does making sure your children are good people ever enter into this equation at all? Join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or text the word START to 69866.
Firestorm, that's a metaphor. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. Not a metaphor, by the way.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.